The coronavirus pandemic is now a national emergency in the U.S. Domestic travel could soon be restricted.
Remember, we are very open-minded about whatever it takes to preserve the health of the American public.
I'm Duarte Geraldino. Today on The Takeaway for March 16th, how restricting travel may or may not help stop the spread of the virus. Also, we hear your thoughts on how the virus is affecting your mental health.
I'm afraid to spend time with loved ones and rarely go outside. Travel restrictions? Try life restrictions.
Then we go to Detroit, where the city is taking measures during this pandemic to turn the water back on for families who can't afford to pay.
At least 2,700 families, households, are without water in Detroit today.
And for a change of pace, we head to outer space. NASA is taking applications for astronauts for the first time in 4 years. But first, more on how the pandemic is impacting you.
It's a very contagious virus. It's incredible, but it's something that we have tremendous control of.
The worst is yet ahead for us. It is how we respond to that challenge that's going to determine what the ultimate endpoint is going to be. The worst is yet ahead.
Two different views from the same lectern on Sunday, President Trump and Dr. Anthony Fauci talking about where we're headed. The news was tough all over. There are now widespread shutdowns of all sorts of places where we gather. Multiple cities ordered bars and restaurants closed, and the largest school district in the U.S. is taking dramatic steps to slow the spread of the virus.
To all parents who are hearing this now, there is no school tomorrow, and we will be suspending our public schools until after the spring vacation.
That's New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio on Sunday announcing the closure of all public schools in the city effective today.
By closing our schools now, we may not have the opportunity to reopen them in this full school year.
A lot of local leaders are echoing that sentiment in multiple states. Coronavirus doesn't just affect public health. The economy is also on a turbulent road. Today, even after the Federal Reserve announced it's dropping interest rates to zero in order to stabilize financial markets, Wall Street plunged Monday morning. As infections and deaths rise, the federal government is floating around the idea of banning domestic travel to slow the spread of the virus. President Trump already placed sweeping travel bans on European countries. Some experts don't think domestic travel restrictions are necessary, and among those is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Dr. Anthony Fauci. But even he admits, keeping you safe may mean some restrictions on travel.
I mean, they've been discussed, but not seriously discussed. I don't see that right now in the immediate future. But remember, we are very open-minded about whatever it takes to preserve the health of the American public.
That was Fauci on ABC's This Week. Fauci and other leaders in the fight against the coronavirus want you to, quote, hunker down, echoing the CDC's calls for social distancing. Fauci also says a two-week nationwide shutdown would not be an overreaction. The CDC is now recommending that no gatherings of over 50 people happen for 8 weeks. Nicole Noria is an immigration reporter for Vox. She's been covering the coronavirus outbreak. Hey, Nicole.
Thanks for having me, Duarte.
And Daniela Ompad is also with us. She's an associate professor of epidemiology at the NYU School of Global Public Health. Daniela, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me as well.
So, Daniela, you're a public health expert. How does traveling, that actual process of getting on trains, buses, automobiles, spread the virus?
So there are a couple ways in which the virus can be spread during the travel process. First, you are often shoulder to shoulder with other people, and we know that there are likely to be a large proportion of people who are infected but are asymptomatic. And so you are in close proximity, possibly to people who may be actively able to transmit the virus. There's also the issue of all the surfaces on trains, on planes, that can be contaminated with the coronavirus. And there are some studies that suggest that the coronavirus stays on surfaces for hours to days, depending on the type of surface. And so it's possible also for transmission by touching those surfaces and then touching your face.
To clarify, Danielle, you say that the virus could stay on surfaces from hours to days. Do you mean plastic versus cloth versus metal? What are we talking about?
Exactly. So the studies that I have seen have suggested that coronavirus can stay on plastic surfaces for at least a couple days.
I see. So, Nicole, China was the first country to enact a travel ban. Was that ban effective? What did we learn from it?
So preliminary research suggests that the domestic travel restrictions implemented in China coupled with international travel restrictions may have helped delay the spread of the virus by a few days. And something like that could be really valuable in terms of buying time for governments and communities to prepare. So public health experts have been telling me that there could be a window in which banning international travel can help buffer against the spread of the virus temporarily.
There were so many people who criticized China's move, saying it was too draconian. But now at this point, are we considering what they did an effective measure? Might that happen in the U.S.?
Domestic travel restrictions could happen in the U.S. as we just heard from Dr. Fauci. That doesn't seem to be something that's immediately on the table, but we could definitely potentially see some travel restrictions in areas where there are high levels of transmission. For example, Washington State and New York State in the city of New Rochelle.
Danielle, in terms of screening, what would we need to happen at the airports or at the bus terminals in order for these travel bans to be effective?
So first of all, I think we need to recognize that it's not just symptomatic people that we need to be concerned about. We also need to think about people who may have been exposed previously. So we need to ask about potential exposures. But it's difficult, right? Because we can ask people if they've been in crowds or been within 6 feet of each other, but that's just about everybody at this point. So I'm not sure that it's going to be easy to screen people for these travel bans.
So what are we likely to see if they start screening people? How are they going to actually screen someone? Is it a questionnaire? Is it taking temperatures?
It may be a questionnaire. It may also be temperatures. And so it's definitely easier to identify people who have symptoms, which is the dry cough, the fever, and the shortness of breath. It's much more difficult to identify people who may have been at risk for exposure.
And what's the window? How long before you actually show any symptoms?
So what we've been seeing is that the average is 5 days, but the range, I think, is 2 to 14. So it's actually quite a wide range.
Mm-hmm. Nicole, I know you've been following the travel bans. We have many cases in Washington State, California, and New York. The thought that it could be spreading domestically and the idea that we could restrict that in some way, do you think it's possible to actually restrict that domestically?
Yeah, for sure. It's not exactly clear how it would work in practice at this point, but the federal government does have the power to regulate interstate commerce, and people moving across state lines would be included in that. So federal officials could potentially quarantine someone who's seeking to enter the country or seeking to cross from one state into another. But mostly individual states have primarily the legal power to decide how they respond to coronavirus. So this could be also a call that's coming from the state level, where state leaders decide to just quarantine people within their states. And we could see that coming down. And I think there could be some legal challenges to that, but courts have historically deferred to public health officials in times of crisis like this.
Danielle, for people who absolutely have to travel, is one mode of travel safer than another? Say, for example, cars versus buses or trains?
I would say that if I had to travel somewhere, I would try to do it in a car to the best of my ability. Obviously, that works for shorter distances because you are going to be limited in the number of people that you're going to be in contact with. And the times at which you'll be in contact with people are at the gas station, at the rest stop, but it won't necessarily be as much continuous exposure to other people as it would be on a bus or a train or a plane.
Nicole, is there any way that the travel ban may actually be increasing the spread of the disease?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, unfortunately, the rollout of this has been really messy. Trump failed to communicate during his announcement of the ban that U.S. citizens and green card holders would be allowed to come home. And that's what caused, you may have seen the photos of crowded airports both in Europe and in the U.S. over the past few days. And in Chicago, for example, there were hundreds of people packed in lines for hours while they waited for these health screenings. So those are the exact kind of conditions that we've been instructed by public health officials to avoid. And yet, this is what happened as soon as the ban was implemented. It's unclear at this point whether there was a lot of transmission going on there. But as we know, people can be asymptomatic for quite a while. There's no real telling how much damage was done there in terms of spreading the virus.
Danielle, on a very, very local level, how safe is it for us to travel within cities, to visit neighbors, across town, to see friends? What are some of the public health concerns with public transportation and just that neighborly knock on the door?
So I would encourage people to stay home as much as possible and to limit their interaction with other people. It's not always about you as the individual. It's about our community. And there are lots of people in our community who are at increased risk for severe coronavirus or even death. And so the risk of going across town, for example, on a bus or a train is that there may be other people on those modes of transportation who are infected either asymptomatically or symptomatically. So there's a potential for transmission there. There is also the potential for transmission by touching some of those surfaces and touching your face. So to the extent possible, we should rely on telephones, or internet communication for the time being. If you have to go see somebody, make sure that you avoid touching as many surfaces as possible and washing your hands thoroughly, as has been discussed previously, before you interact with anybody.
Nicole Narea is an immigration reporter for Vox, and Danielle Ompad is an associate professor of epidemiology at the NYU School of Global Public Health. Danielle, Nicole, thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
As the U.S. and other countries struggle to contain COVID-19, you may be noticing more and more people around you getting anxious. The novel coronavirus is not just affecting physical health. Global pandemics have very real emotional and mental health implications. So much is fueling the anxiety that many of us are feeling right now.
Hi, my name is Wendy Soltis. I'm calling from Ravenel in South Carolina. My concern right now is in not having enough information about how long the virus takes to spread and how long it takes for people to become infected if they're exposed and how long it takes to transmit it and how long it remains alive on different surfaces other than one's hands. I have a spouse who has some ongoing health difficulties, and I work in a grocery store, so those are my primary concerns.
Anxiety surrounding COVID-19 is now so rampant that the World Health Organization issued guidelines for how we can care for our mental health during the outbreak. With me right now is Vail Wright. Vail is a clinical psychologist and director of clinical research and quality at the American Psychological Association. Vail, thanks so much for speaking with us at this very difficult time.
Thanks for having me.
So based on the people with whom you have spoken, how has the pandemic affected our peace of mind? How is it playing out?
You're certainly seeing an increase in anxiety, and I think this is really manifesting itself in a variety of different behaviors, including the panic buying that we've seen, as well as this kind of constant need to be connected to the news and social media, which is also driving up anxiety.
So what accounts for panic buying? What are we actually trying to buy that's going to calm us down?
We're trying to buy back control. So when this situation is as uncertain as it is, it reminds us of all the ways and the things that are out of our control. And so this notion of trying to over-prepare and over-buy things makes us feel like we're regaining some sense of control, but we're really not. And at the end of the day, we might be taking resources away from others. So it's not a very effective way to feel in control.
I'm always perplexed by seeing so many people hoard up on toilet paper instead of food. What is that about?
I think it's coming just from a place of fear, probably a little bit about misconception too, some rumors that were going around that there was going to be a shortage, but also just the sense of if I ran out of something really serious, what would it be? And it might be that.
So how does uncertainty propel anxiety?
So what we know from the psychological science is that those with a real high intolerance of uncertainty have a harder time. It drives up this sense of threat and danger, and then that in turn really manifests itself in anxiety and stress. Now, not everybody is highly intolerant of uncertainty. Some people don't have such a hard time with it, but we know that those who do are really feeling distressed right now.
So what about a country's leadership or the government's response? Does that play a role in anxiety?
The messaging we receive plays a huge role in our anxiety. We know from a recent study out of The Lancet that receiving consistent, accurate, science-based information from leaders does reduce the psychological stress related to social distancing, self-quarantining, and isolation. So that kind of messaging is really critical right now.
When we think about this isolation and social distancing, which is for our own good, it can induce a sense of isolation, this whole idea of working from home. What are the possible mental health considerations when we social distance ourselves?
Well, we know that, again, from the research, that it does have a negative emotional effect. It can be distressing. People can become bored, can become hopeless, depression and anxiety again increase. And that's in part because we're social creatures. We need to be connected to others. So one of the things we're really encouraging people to do is to remember to connect virtually, whether that's text messaging, phone, or video chatting. Really staying connected to loved ones, especially those that are the most vulnerable and isolated, is critical right now.
We know that statistically, if it's not you, then someone you know or love is or was suffering with mental illness or addiction before the outbreak. What does this new normal mean for them and the care that they need?
Yeah, those who had pre-existing mental health or substance use conditions are even more vulnerable than those without. And so we need to be there for supporting them. We need to remind them to take extra care, to double down on their self-care, to make sure they're eating healthy, getting some activity, making sure they're sleeping, sticking to a routine, staying away from alcohol and substances. And again, just really using those coping skills that work for them, exercise, mindfulness, music, whatever it is, just reminding them that they've got to work even harder right now to take care of themselves.
Now, is that what the CDC is also recommending for the social isolation? Because sometimes, you know, you just need a hug.
Yeah. So sometimes you might just need a virtual hug in this case. But I think that we absolutely have to stay connected. We need a sense of community. We're not in this by ourselves. Us keeping ourselves socially isolated or maintaining that distance isn't just to keep ourselves healthy. It's to make sure that we're keeping our whole community healthy. And if we can remind ourselves that this is, you know, everyone in it together, I think that can help too.
So how do you recommend that we actually structure our days and that routine in this new normal?
Should try to keep things as they would have been during a work week or a school week or whatever, you know, your daily routine would have been. So not treating this like a vacation, but instead getting up at the same hour, making sure you're eating your meals at the same times, trying to go to bed at the same time, and maintaining, you know, all those good social hygiene things you would have done, like taking a shower, brushing your teeth, just, you know, really trying to treat this as this is the new normal for right now. Hopefully this isn't going to last forever, but with the uncertainty of when it's going to end, it is certainly a challenging time.
With this collective anxiety that we're all feeling, I wonder, is there any precedent for this in the past?
I think not in most of our adult lifetimes. This is really the first time we've experienced a pandemic related to a biological disease. I think some compare the experience to what it might have been like to go through, say, World War II. But I think for most of us, this is pretty unprecedented, and we're just going to have to get through it together.
They're comparing it to what it would have been like to go through World War II. Well, thank you so much. Vail Wright is the clinical psychologist and director of clinical research and quality at the American Psychological Association. Vail, thanks for joining us.
Thanks again.
There's no way around it. Your life and mine are changing because of the virus. And sometimes we have to just take a breath and calm down. So much of this is a shared experience. You and I are in it together. We are not alone.
Hi, Zohar Zaid, Willits, California. I'm staying home. I canceled a flight abroad. I'm using my cell phone to communicate more with loved ones. Still going out for coffee and groceries. I think this is an opportunity for communities to show kindness within and to support the very small portion of the population who are more vulnerable.
Hi, my name is Laurie. I'm calling from Greenville, South Carolina. Has travel affected me? No, but my mother is now shut in at her assisted living facility, and I'm unable to see her or help her understand my absence. She has dementia and cannot process this.
My name is Leif. I'm calling from Tacoma, and I am swamped by my kids right now because they're all home from school. We're all home from work. We can't go to the library. We can't go to the parks. We can't go to the zoo because everything is shut down by the prohibitions from COVID-19. I personally am a really kind of a huggy guy, kind of a close talker. And the social distancing that is happening because of this is a real problem for me. I think I'm going to slide into depression with the distance that I have to have from everybody now. All right. I hope everyone else is weathering this better than I am.
Hi, Jane Stackhouse, Portland, Oregon. So how am I taking care of myself through this coronavirus? I am feeling a bit isolated, and all my travel plans are on hold. I'd much rather call it physical distancing than social distancing. I need social contact now. So phone calls, email, Skype, Zoom, remote meeting tools are important. Also, going outside for a walk.
Hi, my name is Mary. I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The coronavirus has been affecting my movements in the sense that I don't go out unnecessarily, and I try to avoid places that are crowded or congested. I feel that owing to the fact that I'm 76 and have a heart condition, I can't be too careful. So I'm not going out unless it's necessary, and never to places that are crowded. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Sharon. I'm calling from Pompano Beach. I'm 57 years old and diagnosed with a condition called sarcoidosis, which affects the lungs. I've been trying to stay focused and calm and continuing to work out at a small gym in Coconut Creek. However, I am concerned that's putting myself into at risk, although I understand that keeping active can help build your immune system. So it's 50-50.
I am 70, so I'm working on weekends when no one is there. We live in the country and our internet is unreliable, so I'm unable to work from home. So it's just going to be wait to see where this goes over the next few weeks. This is Jean Whitlock from Fort Collins, Colorado.
I'm Elizabeth. I live in Little Rock, Arkansas. I'm a professional performing artist, so my busiest time of year went from one of my most productive times to an unplanned, unpaid vacation, essentially. So we're doing the best we can, but it's a challenge.
At The Takeaway, we're going to be here with you throughout all of this. Tell us how you're managing. What do you want to know about the coronavirus? Call us. We're listening. We will get you answers. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and leave a voicemail. That's 877-869-8253. You're listening to The Takeaway.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Wash your hands. You've heard that advice. It'll help you avoid being infected with the coronavirus and passing it on to your friends and family. But not everyone has enough water to wash their hands. According to the latest Census Bureau data, roughly 1.6 million people in the U.S. don't have access to a working toilet, shower, or running water in their homes. In fact, since 2014, the city of Detroit, Michigan, has enforced an aggressive policy to shut off water access for residents who don't pay their bills. Just last year, Detroit shut the water off in more than 23,000 homes, and as of this January, more than one-third of them still could not turn the faucet on for water to wash their hands. Now, in response to the coronavirus outbreak, the city of Detroit, along with the state of Michigan, they're both taking emergency steps. They both plan to restore water access. Here's Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan speaking to the press on March 9th.
So if you get a water shutoff notice in the mail or on your door, you contact us and you'll be in a $25 plan to keep the water on. If your water is off, contact us. And for $25, it'll be turned back on. We think we put this in a position where everybody should be able to afford it. But Governor Whitmer said, I don't want there to be any question. And so the state of Michigan has said for the next 30 days, the state will pay the $25.
Detroit is one of several cities, including Seattle and Atlanta, that have announced plans to ease the rules surrounding water shutoffs because of COVID-19. While advocates say this is an important first step, many argue long-term policies need to be geared towards avoiding water shutoffs in the first place. Nina Lacani is an environmental justice reporter for The Guardian U.S. She's with us now. Thanks for being here, Nina.
No problem.
Now, you heard Mayor Mike Duggan outline the plan for Detroit residents this month. Do you have a sense of how many people have had their water turned back on because of the pandemic?
In the first 2 days of this implementation plan, they only managed to turn on water for 73 households. It was low because what they say is that they're having to spend a long time at many people's houses because they have to install meters first.
73 people out of how many? How many are we talking about that don't actually have water?
The numbers are always very confusing, especially from Detroit. What the city told me yesterday, as of 2019 April, they turned off the water for 3,600 occupied homes. So the larger number, 23,000, they say includes a lot of homes that had been abandoned. So even if we take Detroit numbers at face value, they turned off 3,600 occupied homes as of April last year. Last week, when they made the announcement to start reconnecting people, 2,800 families were without water just from that last year. We don't know all the people who have been turned off since 2014, how many of those don't have water. They don't have those numbers. So even if we just take into account those who've been turned off in the last year, at least 2,700 families, households, are without water in Detroit today.
So is the water that people in Detroit have access to actually clean of the ones who have access to water?
Well, that's highly questionable. I mean, one of the things that health campaigners fear is that for those folks who have not had running water for some time, when you turn the water back on, it increases the risk of lead just getting into your water system. So to be fair to the city, they are issuing guidance with every reconnection that people should flush out their taps for at least 30 minutes. And they have to, you know, they send a poster showing them how to take the faucets off and how to do that.
So the city of Detroit is still charging $25 for water access, something that the state of Michigan waived, as you heard, for the first 30 days. Why isn't Detroit waiving that fee too?
Well, the connection fee is being waived and the reconnection fee, and then they're charging $25. I mean, you know, it's a really complicated issue, but at the end of the day, water is a human right. And what we've seen since Detroit has made this announcement is 90 cities and states across the US have suspended water shutoffs for residents who are unable to afford their bills. So we have seen this increasing, and it's a growing number every day. But I just think it's a really important point to say that only 20% of those cities and states have agreed to reconnect people. So while a growing number are saying, okay, we're going to suspend shutoffs during the COVID-19 pandemic, most of them are not agreeing to reconnect people. And so that means hundreds of thousands of Americans potentially today are unable to wash their hands with running water in their homes.
Hundreds of thousands of Americans right now can't turn on a faucet and wash their hands because of these policies to make sure water bills are paid. I want to make sure that we have these numbers again. So you say 90 cities and states have these policies in place?
90 cities and states have so far agreed to suspend water shutoffs far more haven't. I mean, there are many, many more that haven't. I mean, basically water departments across the country, and I'm talking right here about public water departments. Private water utilities do their own thing. And so that's a whole nother story. But you know, public water departments generally use two punitive measures to try and get people to pay their bills, both of which are ineffective from what I can see. Either to shut people's water off when they get into water debt, and let's be straight, with rising water costs, some people are thousands and thousands of dollars in debt to the water department. And these are low income families, right? And so they're not only struggling to pay their water bill, they're also struggling to pay all bills, you know, many, their gas bill, their electric bill, to buy enough healthy food for their families. And the other measure used by some water departments is to put liens on people's houses. So you can risk your losing your house because of a water debt.
You say only 20% of these places have actually agreed to reconnect the water. What are places like Atlanta and Seattle? Why are they not restoring water access for people who have had it shut off in the past?
I don't know why. I mean, it's, you know, I'm assuming it's a matter of cost and time. I mean, one of the things that this pandemic has highlighted is that we do not have accurate nationwide figures on who and where and why people are having their water turned off, you know. And so, though, yes, you know, we have to say great 90 cities and states, and I'm sure it's more, those numbers were accurate as of yesterday. It's going to be more today, have agreed to suspend water shutoffs. Many more haven't. And, like, you know, like you say, a minority, just 20%, have agreed to reconnect people's water at this point.
Nina Lakhani is an environmental justice reporter for The Guardian US. Thanks so much, Nina.
You're welcome.
With coronavirus making us anxious here on Earth, let's focus for a minute on outer space. For the first time in 4 years, NASA is taking applications for astronauts. New astronauts are likely to be part of future expeditions to the moon and Mars. Competition is expected to be stiff. During the last round, NASA only accepted 12 people out of more than 18,000 applications. Women are a big piece of NASA's future. Last month, NASA astronaut Christina Koch returned to Earth after 328 days in space. Hers was the longest single space flight in history by a woman. Now, Katie Coleman is a former astronaut with NASA. She's here to explain what it takes to go into space. Katie, thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thanks. It's a great subject. I'm so excited about the new selection.
Also with us is Mary Robinette Kowal. She wrote the Lady Astronaut series. She's also a science fiction writer. As part of her writing, Mary Robinette has done extensive research on the world of astronauts and how gender specifically plays a role in making it to NASA and succeeding there. Mary Robinette, thank you so much for being here on the show.
I'm delighted to be here.
So, Katie, we start with you. Give us the basics here. What does it take to actually be an astronaut at NASA?
Well, I'm going to start by saying less than you think. You know, it's so many people, so many more people are qualified than apply. And basically, you need right now a master's degree in a STEM field or the equivalent and plus some experience in your field. And there's so many people that have actually those qualifications that don't apply. And amongst them, I'm going to say a lot of women and minorities. And so I'm really so happy that you're talking about it on your program so that maybe we can get the word out that basically space is for everyone. And I'll say, wow, space is for women.
The first time you looked at Earth from outer space, what was it like?
The biggest thing, I think, is that you just think that that's something other people are going to see, not you. And to realize that you're really in that place, for me, in the space shuttle, looking down, seeing the Earth go by, and also realizing that it's our whole place. I mean, everyone is here. And even before, you know, the troubles that we have, you know, particularly now with coronavirus, where people are suddenly working together who hadn't expected to, it was always very clear to me that if people could only realize that they're all in the same place and they're all from the same place, we could solve anything.
So what type of unique challenges do women face in applying?
First of all, realizing that their names and their qualifications belong on those applications and that they would be amazing astronauts. And actually, I would sort of throw it to Mary Robinette in that I think part of the reason that doesn't happen enough, that qualified women and minorities don't apply, is that they don't necessarily see themselves in those roles. And part of that is because whenever they watch TV or advertisements or read books, they seldom see themselves in those roles.
Mary, how are you countering that?
I think that she's absolutely right. We're starting to see that shift. Films like Hidden Figures reminded people that women have been involved, especially African-American women, have been involved with the space program since very, very early on. But a lot of the early science fiction was written by men for men. You've got characters like Wilma Deering in Buck Rogers. And it's not until later that you start to have women that are in leadership roles. And I think that's one of the things that happens with women. We hear this in a lot of different fields, that we tend to self-select ourselves out, even when we're qualified. But the other aspect of it is that when you're thinking about the women who are entering the field now, the average age of a woman entering NASA as an astronaut, or the average age of an astronaut, is about 38. And when you think about the way culture was leading up to that point, and all of the barriers that were in place 20 years ago, when women were entering the various STEM fields, you see the number of different things that kind of stood between them in getting the job experience they needed to be qualified now. So one of the things that I can do as a science fiction writer, and other people in media can do, is to try to increase that representation, to remind women that these are options, and also to train men and the other people in the workplace around them that these are options, that you don't have to go with this one particular image in your head. Katie has this great story about her son seeing a picture of an astronaut that I think is completely on point about this.
Katie, can you share that story briefly?
Well, my son, who's now 19, actually, and I think asleep. But anyways, it was when he was about 4, and there was a giant cutout. I was at some event, and he came with me, and there was a giant cutout of a person in a spacesuit. And it's really kind of hard to see who that person is. And he says, "Mommy, is that you?" I said, "No, that one's not me." And he goes, "Well, then, if it's not you, whose mommy is it?"
I love it.
He grew up in a different world.
Mary Robinette, are there any particular strengths that women bring to the field?
So it's an interesting question. There's a couple of different areas historically that women have tested better than men. We, even though I am not actually qualified in any way, shape, or form to be an astronaut because I am not in the STEM fields, but we tolerate higher Gs than men do. Some of that has to do simply with stature, but it is a very useful thing when launching. The other thing that's been interesting historically is that women do much better on stress tests. When the Mercury 13, which were first lady astronaut trainees, were going through the same Mercury tests that the men did, they performed on the stress tests magnitudes better than the men. One example is they had sensory deprivation, and the record for a man was, I think, 3 hours. They had to stop the test after 9 hours because she had just fallen asleep.
Wait a minute. She fell asleep after 9 hours?
She was just like, "Oh, sensory deprivation. This is nice." One of them was the mother of 8, and I kind of imagine that in her head she's like, "So when is this test going to start?"
Katie, briefly, what excites you most about NASA's future?
It's the fact that we are absolutely exploring further. I mean, going back to the moon, going on to Mars. I mean, this is our place. I mean, one thing I learned from going to space is that I always thought space was somewhere else, but actually it belongs to all of us. And there's no question that people, and we have to bring all of them, really, all the different kinds of people, they are the ones, and we are the ones that will explore it all starts with that application, and I can only beg everyone who dreams of going and being part of it, fill out that application, celebrate who you are.
Katie Coleman is a former NASA astronaut, and Mary Robinette Kowal is a science fiction writer and the author of the Lady Astronaut series. Thank you so much for joining and inspiring us. And that's it for us today. You can follow me on Twitter at Duarte Geraldino, and you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. So good to be with you. I'm Duarte Geraldino, and you're listening to The Takeaway. Talk to you tomorrow. Please stay safe.